It's Friday morning, not the afternoon because I have afternoon court an hour away from here, and we've locked the door because it's the easiest way to keep the cheeseburger guy from delivering the cheeseburgers. Cheeseburgers. And also because it's time for another edition of our weekly podcast, Tales from the Brown Desk. I'm Jake Rigney of Rigney Law, LLC. With me as usual is my law partner, wife, and my future cause of death, Cassie Rigney. Terry Ulm is our host, topic selector, Florida man monitor, and email screener. Just leave that mistake in. It's fine. Everyone will love it. Friendly reminder, Tales from the Brown Desk is a free-flowing conversation involving two foul-mouthed attorneys. It may include graphic descriptions of sexual activity, violence, and the imaginary altercations between two Supreme Court justices fighting over the last beignet at a tea party. Who writes this? Oh, I do. Shit. It may not be suitable for children, everyone else, no one else, our collective consciousness, or the invisible man that my dad told me was always watching me wherever I went back when I was a little kid. That is real and serious. My dad told me there was an invisible man in the room with me. It was not at all creepy. Listener discretion is advised. Here's Terry.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Jake. How are you this morning?
I am no longer afraid of the invisible man that lives in my room with me, Terry. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad you aren't afraid. We'd have to have a discussion about that
nope,
if you were.
I'm good now.
Good. Hi, Cassie. How are you?
Hi, Terry. I'm fine. Thank you.
Good. So last week we talked about Operation Legend, stacking charges, and about a very important Indiana Supreme Court opinion that changed the controlling law in Indiana when it comes to double jeopardy.
Which I still haven't read.
Did we? We didn't finish that discussion, though. We talked about it, but...
Yeah, we talked about it.
I think what we concluded that when the issue comes up, we have some research to do.
Exactly.
Right. That's what a good lawyer would do, though.
Exactly.
Like, if one of my clients called me up and said, hey, how's my case going? I said, I don't know. I had to read a bunch of Court of Appeals opinions that don't apply to your case. So, sorry, I didn't have time to get to it. He'd be like, what the hell, man? And I'd be like, sorry, Chad.
Sorry.
But that's, no, we have work to do. Reading opinions is our job sometimes. It's not what we usually are getting paid to do.
Yes. So this week, we're going to talk about IMPD's new oversight board.
Okay.
The trial penalty and the Sixth Amendment right to trial.
The trial tax.
Yeah, and to answer some commonly asked criminal law questions.
Okay.
So Wish TV 8 reports that the Indianapolis City Council will overhaul IMPD's oversight board, given civilians greater control over police. The proposal creates a 7-person general orders board to help write policing policies and rules for the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. Mm-hmm. It will add 4 civilians to the current 3 law enforcement officers on the previous general orders committee.
Right.
Now, the reason behind adding civilians is to provide accountability and other perspectives to IMPD policy. The mayor, the council, and the police chief will each appoint 2 members to the civilian board, and the Fraternal Order of Police will appoint the final member. Supporters of the plan say it's an important step to hold officers accountable, while opponents worry that it will hurt police morale and that the new plan will essentially strip the police chief of his authority over internal decisions. What do you two think about this new plan?
I think that it is a very positive development for the police department in general. I think that there are certain police officers and certain other people around law enforcement who will pitch a big fit about it and who will complain about it. But the truth is that good, hardworking, reasonable police officers who simply want to keep people safe and do their job are going to have no problem with a civilian oversight. It wouldn't matter who their boss was, right? It could be the mayor. It could be the police chief. It could be 73 civilians who look at things and try to decide. And it would be fine because most police officers are decent, normal folks trying to do a job who don't want to hurt people and they just want to protect and serve their community. And this oversight board will have no impact on their job. Now, There are certain police officers who live in fear and who want to insulate themselves and pretend that there's this thin blue line between them and everyone else, and that no one else understands what their job is like, and no one else can support them, and those people will act scared. But what they really want to do, or what they do, what their fear allows them to do, is create space, insulation and space for bad things to happen. And that's what the point of this is, to eliminate some of that space, eliminate some of the ability for bad police officers to do bad things and get away with it. And it's not surprising after what we saw in Minnesota and how many times that guy'd been in trouble and he was still out on the beat, still walking around, still allowed to arrest people.
And training people.
Yeah, and training people. Absolutely. So it's not surprising that we're going to move to that. And it is probably not going to end there, but I think that that's a good step for the police department. And for most police officers, it won't matter.
I agree. I think further additional transparency to the police departments is important and would help build confidence in what they do. My experience as a former prosecutor, I felt like that those protections and secrecy allow bad things to happen, allow, in the name of where the good guys, start bending the rules and pushing the law. And it was always my opinion that the prosecutor was supposed to be the check and balance there. And sometimes that's not happening. So it sounds like, maybe we need to expand that realm of view.
Yeah, somewhere along the way, as a society, we kind of got okay with the idea of secret police, right? Which is weird, because when you just hear the words secret police, you think that's not something I want in my community. But the truth is, in this community and in pretty much every community in the United States that has police officers, there is secrecy involved. They do things that they will fight to prevent from letting the public know. And I know this because Cassie and I worked with them for a long time, and sometimes we helped them keep those things secret, in particular, confidential witnesses and things like that. We helped them do that for a while. They will always want to keep some things secret. And that is secret policing. That is having secret police. When you think about it like that, whether you really want that or not, sometimes it causes you to sort of re-examine how okay you are with the way we do these things. And I know that was one of the reasons why, my mind has changed over the last 10 or 15 years about how I feel about the police a little bit. Not about most of them. Most of them are, like I said, hardworking people who just want to serve their community and perform their job. But there are some of them who believe in this us versus them, insulated sheepdogs versus the wolves world, where they're good and everyone else is bad. And, that's a real bad thing.
It is. So now we're going to move on to our next topic, and that is the Sixth Amendment right to trial and the trial penalty. In 2018, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers published a report titled "The Trial Penalty: The Sixth Amendment Right to Trial on the Verge of Extinction and How to Save It." The report examines specific cases, data, and statistics to explain the decline in the criminal trial and the steady rise in plea deals. The report found that over the last 50 years, defendants choose trial in less than 3% of state and federal criminal cases, compared to 30 years ago, when 20% of those arrested chose trial. The remaining 97% of the cases were resolved through plea deals. With 97% of criminal cases being resolved by plea in a constitutional system predicated upon the Sixth Amendment right to trial, the fact of imbalance and injustice in the system is self-evident. Guilty pleas have replaced trials for a very simple reason. Individuals who choose to exercise their Sixth Amendment right to trial face higher sentences if they invoke their right to trial and lose. The trial penalty is now so severe and pervasive that it has virtually eliminated the constitutional right to trial. To avoid the penalty, accused people must surrender their fundamental rights, which are essential to a fair justice system. The report's solutions, they have many recommendations, which include providing defendants with full discovery, scrutinizing plea bargains, and repealing mandatory minimum sentences. What are your thoughts on this report and the recommendations?
My initial reaction seems to presume that all pleas are bad and that somehow pleas, you know, giving up your right to discovery. As a practical standpoint, that's something I do before I would even begin negotiating. So the point that it's indicating that defendants are not getting discovery, I take issue to that. I know that there are problems, but I'm not sure they get it right.
It hasn't been our experience that typically on a lot of cases we are making decisions about plea agreements before discovery, unless a client comes to us and says, hey, I'm guilty, let's just get this worked out. And that happens sometimes, but more often than not, what I tell people at the start of my consultations with them is, let's get a look at the discovery and see whether they've got a good case against you, a bad case against you, or something else, and then we'll figure out what we want to do next. We don't have experience in every jurisdiction, and maybe we work with better prosecutors than normal, than average, I don't know. But discovery, or lack thereof, is not typically a problem for us on a large scale.
What about the recommendation of repealing the mandatory minimum?
It's one of those things that there's anecdotal problems with minimums and without minimums. It's tough. And, you know, as an attorney, I know each case is, when it gets in front of court, in front of the judge, handled by competent attorneys, that issue is vetted and it's judged according to the law and based on its facts and evidence available in that case. Now, you know, within the law, you know, we can argue within that, but we trust the process. And, you know, they're good and they're bad, and further evaluation could be justified, but I don't think that just a hard line across the board is the right answer.
Yeah. For those who aren't familiar with what mandatory minimum means, there are certain crimes in certain jurisdictions where you are required to receive a prison sentence. You cannot receive a suspended sentence. A certain portion of your sentence must be served in prison. They changed it, but back before they changed it, in Indiana, for example, armed robbery carried a mandatory minimum sentence of 6 years in prison. If you were good while you were in prison, you'd get out in 3. Now, you got credit for time served, too, so the time you sat in jail while you were waiting counted, but still, a mandatory minimum prison sentence. Mandatory minimums bring up sort of an interesting office philosophical problem that I dealt with when I was a supervisor at the prosecutor's office a little bit too, right? When you have somebody who makes a mistake or breaks a rule or does something stupid, even if it's not a rule, what do you do in response, right? Do you make an office-wide rule, or do you just sanction the person that offended in a way that makes sense, right? Pretend what they did was here's the classic, they cooked fish in the microwave, right? In the office, you got the guy who cooks fish in the microwave, right? For those of you who've never smelled what fish smells like when you cook it in the microwave, it's wildly disgusting. It is terrible. It's like, it smells like dead fish, basically. And it travels too. Like the smell travels. It's not like just around the microwave. Within a minute, it's like 40 feet down the hall into people's offices. So you've got the guy in your office who cooks fish in the microwave, right? What do you do? You can either make a rule, no one cooks fish in the microwave, period. And then you start trying to figure out, well, is crab fish, are snails fish? Like, then you got to figure out all sorts of other more complicated questions that apply to that rule. Or do you just tell Steve, hey, like, don't cook your fish in the microwave. Chad, sorry. Tell Chad, don't cook fish in the microwave, right? And then if Chad does it again, maybe he gets a worse sanction. I don't know. This same sort of problem applies to criminal cases, right? Do you punish everyone? Do you make a rule that punishes everyone the same? Or do you just deal with the person as they come to you, right? And what the legislature had done for a long time was they just created a rule for the whole office, right? They just said, no one cooks fish in the office and you get fired if you do. Although it was, no one should commit armed robbery, and if you do, you go to prison. There's been quite a movement to pull back on mandatory minimums and simply deal with cases on a case-by-case basis. But as Cassie points out, that also has drawbacks, right? Because, for example, when you don't have mandatory minimums, a person like Brock Turner in Ohio doesn't get prison time for raping a girl, right? That was a situation where he didn't have a mandatory minimum, and the judge decided, you know, the white college swimmer from Stanford deserved to not go to prison despite doing some pretty dreadful things to a girl. So that's the downside to mandatory minimums. How we sort those issues out is one of the most difficult questions that legislators deal with when they're dealing with criminal law. And I don't think there's a good answer, but it always depends on the case, because as soon as you make mandatory minimums, there will be a defendant out there who you think, well, that guy really probably shouldn't go to prison for that.
Are fish reheating fish sticks cooking fish?
Right, because there are like fish sticks that are just made to be cooked in the microwave. I don't know.
I shouldn't get the same problem as Chad.
Now you get fired just like Chad.
But they were fish sticks.
So in past episodes, we've touched on a little bit about mitigators and aggravators that a judge would consider at sentencing. Mm-hmm. I walked away from one of the episodes thinking that if a defendant waived their right to a jury trial, it was considered a mitigator at sentencing because trials cost a lot of money. They take up a lot of time. So the person was kind of given credit for not taking up that time. Is that right? Or is waiving the right to a jury trial or even a bench trial a mitigator at sentencing?
No. By the statute, waiving your right to a trial is not a mitigator. Accepting responsibility for your actions is, and typically they go hand in hand as part of a plea agreement. But the statute also says you can argue pretty much anything you want is an aggravator or a mitigator, and it's up to the judge to decide. So you can, defense attorneys do argue sometimes that if a defendant waived jury trial and had a bench trial instead, then they saved the state time and money, and that that deserves some mitigation. And I think that that argument is sometimes accepted by judges, although I don't think that you will ever go to court and hear a judge say that. You will also never go to court and hear a judge say, I'm giving you a worse sentence because you went to jury trial, because they're not allowed to do that. Although in practice, my belief is, and people can disagree with me and judges can deny it, and that's fine. My belief is that people do receive harsher sentences for going to jury trial, even though a judge will never say that on the record.
Now we're going to move on to some commonly asked criminal law questions. And the first question is, what constitutional rights would I waive by pleading guilty?
Generally, a whole page of those. You right to trial, right to be proven guilty, right to remain silent, right to confront and cross-examine witnesses, right to have the court assist you in compelling witnesses on your behalf and producing evidence.
And the right to appeal.
Hey.
Nice.
We give those, we tell people about those rights a lot.
Probably. I mean, your criminal defense attorneys.
Well, now I'm disappointed in myself that I forgot appeal.
It's okay, Cassie. I forget one of them sometimes, too. That's why they're written down in a plea agreement, so we never have to figure out whether or not we told them later. In fact, usually they have little blanks for initials next to them, and you have the defendant initial them just to prove he read them all. He knows that he's waiving them.
Now, if someone pled guilty, even though they weren't, is there any way they can fix that later on?
Not through that, not by coming back and saying that they lied in their guilty plea. There may be other avenues to attack the conviction.
It depends on what they pled guilty to and how they pled guilty to it, right? In Indiana, and probably in just about every place in the country, you do not just stand up and say, I plead guilty, and then you get sentenced. Typically, the judge will require some type of summary of the evidence, which the defendant then has to waive his right to remain silent and admit to happening. Now, in certain places, there are no contest pleas, which are a little bit different, but they don't have that in Indiana. And in Indiana, every defendant essentially has to admit that they committed the crime. Now, if there was some mistake with that presentation during the guilty plea and sentencing hearing, that can cause a conviction to get overturned in a post-conviction relief proceeding, a PCR. So the normal way, I shouldn't say the normal way, but the most common way I've seen that judges do this in guilty plea and sentencing hearings is they have the state summarize their evidence and then they ask the defendant whether that's what happened or not. So if there was some error in what the state said, if they left one of the elements of the crime completely out, by the way, or, you know, for example, then the defendant never actually pled guilty because he never admitted to a crime, and that could cause it to get overturned. But assuming all that went correctly, it is very difficult to get out of a guilty plea, although it is possible through a PCR proceeding. And there are a multitude of different ways you can try to do that. Most of them do not work. It is pretty rare that that happens. But it has happened before and it will happen again.
Now, can a defendant in a criminal case change their lawyer in the middle of the case, at the beginning? Can they change their lawyer? Can they get a different one?
Certainly, they can change their lawyer. Now, they can't pick what public defender they get assigned. Generally, the agency gets assigned and then they dole out what attorneys. But if they have the money to hire somebody, they can hire somebody almost at any time of the case. You know, it wouldn't really be advisable to swap out in the middle of a trial, but I want to say I had actually seen that happen as a young prosecutor, that somebody hired somebody in the last minute to sit at that trial table. But you can hire somebody whenever you want. The question is, how much time is the court going to give that person? The trouble can be if you try to hire someone new, like on the morning of trial, and that person is going to try and continue the trial. If that is perceived as a delay tactic on part of the defendant, you could potentially be denied, or at least denied the continuance, maybe.
Yeah, that can happen. There are a couple of judges in Marion County in particular who will get very annoyed if a private defense attorney enters their appearance right before the trial and then asks for a continuance. And oftentimes they will not grant the continuance and say, it's going to trial. Get ready. You knew it was set for trial when you entered your appearance. So get ready.
Should a guilty defendant in a criminal case spill their beans to the lawyer, tell the lawyer the truth?
Guilty or innocent, if you hire an attorney, you're going to get the best advice by being honest. So you should. Your attorney is in their best place to help you if you tell them everything. And you have the confidentiality. There's no reason not to. In my opinion, you're only harming yourself and your defense by denying your representative all of the information.
That can be kind of a tricky situation, right? Because I think that some defendants feel like if they admit they committed a crime, their attorney won't work as hard to help them. And I can see their point. Like, I can imagine that there are some attorneys who that is the case with. You know, they think, well, he's guilty anyway. I've got other things I need to work on. At the same time, an attorney is generally only as good as the information that they're given. Right. If you give them bad information, then you're a lot more likely to get a bad result. Because if they don't know everything that you can tell them, then they can't anticipate the problems that that information can present. Right. And as a defense attorney, if I believe my client has a defense, or if I know, when I know exactly what happened, not only do I know where to look, I know where not to look, right? Because if I know I'm going to focus on one element of the state's case that is weaker or may be problematic, and I know that the other areas are strong, I don't look into those strong areas because all I'm going to find is more evidence for the state, right? And I don't want to do that because that hurts my client. So when I have all the information, I know where to look, but also where not to look. And that's sometimes just as important.
Now we are going to cut to a short commercial break. And when we come back, we will bring you the latest Florida Man news.
Today's update on Florida Man is brought to you by the United States Constitution. Remember that old dusty thing? You know, it's the document that everyone in your Facebook feed is an expert on, despite the fact they've never read a word of it.
Commerce Clause, Article 3. I don't know what any of that shit means, but I will quote the shit out of that meaningless preamble, just as long as it tells me the same thing my pastor said last Sunday. And if you quote some other part of it that contradicts me, well, you should spend some time reading Hunter Biden's emails so you can get the real story.
Thank you for reminding me why I put a personal one-hour limit on my social media, Cletus.
You are very welcome.
News Channel 8 in Florida reports that pedestrian Florida man was struck and killed by a car. When two Florida deputies responded to the crash, both in separate cars, they each hit the body, still laying in the road.
Oh, I mean, I feel bad, but I assume he didn't suffer.
Well, and it makes me think that maybe he was in a really bad place. I mean, like, clearly people were not seeing him there.
I think maybe that intersection needs some more lighting.
Definitely.
Man.
Now, in situations like this, when a vehicle hits a pedestrian and kills them, is that a crime?
Well, it can be, yeah. It depends on, mainly it depends on their state of mind, right? So if you intend to, or knowingly, run someone over, that can be, and it kills them, that can be murder, absolutely. If you do it in a sudden rage, you're probably talking about voluntary manslaughter.
Well, remember we've previously discussed about, you know, vacationing in a recreational marijuana state and returning to your home state of Indiana. You could be driving around, speed limit, seatbelt, watching the road. Person steps out in front of you and you hit and kill them. You may have done nothing wrong, but your blood will be taken because you were involved in a serious bodily injury. And if you test with metabolites, they will charge you for that as a crime.
Now, if they're doing their job, they will, in Cassie's explanation, they will only charge you with operating with a metabolite in your blood, not operating with a metabolite in your blood causing death. But if you did anything wrong while you were driving with that metabolite, then you might get charged with causing death. You can also get charged with reckless homicide if you're driving just crazy. You know, if you're going 30 or 40 miles an hour over the speed limit and you run over somebody in an intersection, yeah, you can get charged with reckless homicide in that situation. Then there's the criminal recklessness statute, which has like 7 different levels, and you can potentially get charged with any one of them. So there are a lot of different ways you can get charged in car crashes beyond sort of the obvious OWI situations. Even if you're sober, if you're going 30 or 40 or 50 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour over the limit and you kill somebody, you're probably going to get charged with a pretty serious offense.
CBS 12 in Florida reports, Florida men duo are named the dumbest thieves of the week. Two Florida men earned this distinction because the Marion County Sheriff's Office in Florida had little trouble arresting them after a string of burglaries and thefts. According to investigators, the two Florida men were breaking into stores, stealing cigarettes and lottery tickets.
Yeah. What else would you steal if you're a Florida man?
Gotta get those scratchers.
The two Florida men left a few things behind during their crime spree.
Their IDs.
like a shoe and tools. And one Florida man, he left his wallet with his driver's license.
Yeah, I saw that one coming.
Yep. So deputies went to his home and knocked on the door, and Florida man confessed to it all.
then he confessed. So in case anyone was wondering, admitting that you committed crimes to the police is usually not a good idea. It often does not help you. If you are going to do it, make sure you talk to a lawyer first, and potentially the lawyer's there with you.
Boldy reports that Florida woman blames a windy day for blowing cocaine into her purse.
I like it. It's an improvement from the not my pants defense.
Force of nature defense.
Yeah, a Florida woman was arrested for cocaine possession, and she claimed that the wind blew the illegal drug into her purse. Florida woman was in a car with another person in the vehicle when it was stopped. And according to Local 10 News, Florida woman's car was stopped because it was swerving. As soon as the officer approached the vehicle, there was a strong smell of marijuana in the air. The purse on Florida woman's lap had the goods, a separate bag of marijuana and cocaine. Florida woman fessed up to the marijuana pretty quickly. However, the cocaine, she tried her hardest to pass the buck to the wind.
Right. So she couldn't say that the purse wasn't hers after she admitted that the marijuana was hers. So then she was, and by the way, how awesome would Florida be if there was just cocaine in the wind? You just take a deep breath in through your nose and you're hooked.
Yeah. Well, the officer didn't buy Florida woman's story, and she was arrested on one count of cocaine possession and a misdemeanor count of marijuana possession. One last little tidbit on Florida man. Did you know that there is a board game?
No.
There's a Florida man board game?
There's a Florida man board game. Previews World has a Florida man board game. The Gator Gazette Florida man features headlines that the players have to guess if they are true or false. And this game is for sale online for $20.
We should probably order it and play it next week. I'll tell you what, everybody. Send Terry an email if you want us to play Florida Man on our the Florida Man headline game on the podcast next week. And if you don't, just don't send her an email. If we get, what's our record for emails? Is it two?
We've had more than two, like
in a week.
Oh, probably two.
Two in a week. So if we get,
I mean, historically.
If we get three emails this week saying we should play the Florida Man board game, I'll buy it. It's a business expense. And we'll play it on the air the week after.
The board's really cute. It's shaped like Florida.
Ugh. Florida is not shaped cute. What are you talking about?
You know, it's like the limp dick of the country. Right?
Terry had clearly,
did I not know? Is this not a thing?
Terry had clearly never thought of that.
Oh.
Because... She is now mortified.
It seemed obvious when I look at the map.
Picturing Florida now, and I'll never look at it the same, ever.
You know, it just kind of hangs out there, you know?
Is that all the time we have for this week? Terry is silently laughing. You can laugh out loud, Terry. It's supposed to be funny.
I'm laughing so hard I can't laugh out loud. Poor Florida. It's not cute anymore. And that is all the time we have for the day.
All right. Thanks, Terry. And thank you for listening to Tales from the Brown Desk. Please remember, while we may discuss legal issues and provide information regarding the law to our listeners, we do not intend to create an attorney-client relationship with any listener. Our advice may not be applicable to some legal issues. Please consult with an attorney you've hired to review your legal situation before you attempt to apply the things we have said to your case. Tales from the Brown Desk is produced by Rigney Law and edited by Terry Ulm. If you want to ask a listener question, email Terry at terry@rigneylawindy.com and entitle your email podcast question, and we'll read it on our next podcast. If you want us to play the Florida Man board game, email Terry about that too. Same email address. Give us new content. Please email us with stuff, questions. Buzzsprout says this podcast will get 26 downloads. That's an 8% increase over last week. Bangin' yo.
Wow, how'd they project 8% increase?
No, I just did the math. We went from 24 to 26. That's 8% increase. Oh.
Do we have new listeners?
Apparently, yeah. Our last podcast, the newest faraway listener is in Lake Stevens, Washington, which is a northern Seattle suburb. Probably family members of mine is my guess. Distant family, or not distant, I don't know, but family. Probably my mom's cousins is my guess. That's the only reason I can imagine somebody from Seattle or any rational human being, for that matter, would listen to this podcast. Thankfully for us, there are plenty of irrational people out there. The attorneys at Rigney Law do not comment on their current pending cases. Nothing we've said in this podcast is a comment on a case we are currently working on, even if your name is Chad, or if you worship a document that says black people are only 3/5 of a person. Take it easy, everybody.